Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 264, Beyond Forgiveness, Reflections on Atonement, with Phil Cousineau. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
When we attempt to say we're sorry and we seek forgiveness, well, what happens is very often the world doesn't believe us. We don't believe ourselves. But there is this missing key. Atonement says you need to sacrifice something. You need to prove with an actual act, a human act, that you can put things right again.
That was the voice of my guest, Phil Cousineau, speaking about the importance of atonement in the process of seeking forgiveness. Phil Cousineau is editor of the 2011 book, Beyond Forgiveness, Reflections on Atonement. Phil is an award-winning writer and filmmaker, teacher and editor, lecturer and travel leader, storyteller and TV host. His fascination with the art, literature, and history of culture has taken him from Michigan to Marrakesh, Iceland to the Amazon, in a worldwide search for what the ancients called the soul of the world. With more than 25 books and 15 script-writing credits to his name, the omnipresent influence of myth in modern life is a thread that runs through all of his work. His other books include Stoking the Creative Fires, Once and Future Myths, The Art of Pilgrimage, The Olympic Odyssey, The Hero's Journey, and Word Catcher. Now, here's the interview. Phil Cousineau, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Good morning. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, I'm really happy to have you here and to have this opportunity to meet with you and to discuss your work. I've been reading your current book, Beyond Forgiveness, Reflections on Atonement, and it's a collection of essays by various writers on themes of forgiveness, atonement, and restoring balance in our lives and in the world. It's a wonderful collection, and I was gratified to discover that I've actually previously interviewed two of your contributors, namely Edward Tick and Azim Kamisa, and both of those interviews stand out in my mind as just really extraordinary. How did you come to edit this book?
Well, again, thank you for having me on the show. This is a very difficult but very, very important topic. I'm convinced of that. And the roots of the book are curious. I have been hosting a TV show for Link TV, available all around the world now, linktv.org, called Global Spirit. And a couple of years ago, I had Azim Kamisa, Ed Tick, and his wife, Kate Dahlstedt, on a show under the theme of forgiveness and healing. Ed and Kate told about taking Vietnam veterans back to Vietnam to the points of their trauma and helping them atone for things that have still been weighing deeply, deeply in their hearts. And Azim Kamisa told his tragic story of his 20-year-old son being murdered in the gangland slain in South Central Los Angeles, and then moving to forgive the killer of his son and allowing this young man who is still in prison to atone for what had happened. And shortly after we had this show, Azim called me and said that a friend of his, Rich Meyer, from Southern California, was very interested in this topic, and he wanted to talk to me about perhaps expanding it into a book. So we spoke briefly after that, and I was immediately impressed with the depth of Mr. Meyer's commitment to this idea that forgiveness is fine, important, and noble, but we need the missing key, the missing element in at least long-lasting deeply lasting reconciliation, and that is atonement. This is something that he had picked up in his work in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know that component of it. But as he began to speak, it resonated very deeply with me. In my work with Native Americans, it's a common theme. In my work in film criticism, atonement is omnipresent throughout movie history. And so Rich told me that he had a few commitments already to create the book from people like Michael Negler at the Center for Nonviolence, Michael Beckwith at the Center of Spirituality, Rabbi Lerner, the founder of Tikkun Magazine, and so on. And together we've worked for 2 years on the book, and we expanded his original 5-essay idea for the book into 15. So now this book, Beyond Forgiveness, Reflections on Atonement, published by Josie Bass this year, is chock full of deeply moving and enriching essays on this, I think, very important topic.
Yes, and I have to say I'm a bit envious that you got to meet Kazim and Tick in person. I was certainly impressed by my contact with them, you know, over the phone interviewing them, but I certainly had the feeling that both were extraordinary people. And it's interesting how those two people sort of were the seed for this idea breaking out. Now, your book is both about forgiveness and, as you point out, that second step, important step of atonement. But for a moment, let's break these out separately, if possible, and have you talk a bit about forgiveness. Because I know that's been an important topic. I've been following developments in positive psychology. And forgiveness has been an important theme there. What's meant by forgiveness, and why is it important from your point of view?
Well, first of all, I like going to the words themselves that we use. I've done this in all my work, all my lectures. I have great fun with etymologies. I've learned how to use dictionaries since I was a boy growing up outside Detroit. And my recent book, by the way, is Word Catcher, a book on the importance of word origin. And in this particular discussion, it's enormously enlightening, let's put it that way. To forgive means a couple of things. One, it means to pardon a debt or a wrong. It means to overlook it once the sting of betrayal or wounding of some kind has come in. And yet, if you go deeper into the word, there's something subtly psychological about it as well. It means to give for. It's forgiving, which suggests that it's actually a gift. You've been wronged, and someone on the other side may or may not feel guilty about this, but to offer forgiveness is a gift to that other person to go on with his or her life. It's a gift to yourself to not be stuck in the wound, to be stuck in resentment or bitterness. Well, it's a great Chinese saying, if you are hell-bent on revenge, dig two graves. It's a very powerful thought, in that forgiveness has been a component of human relationships since the red dawn of time. We know that we can very well spend our lives in resentment, but we will be hobbled by that. So there's this component that says it's a gift. If you can move, and we need compassion to actually overlook, as the word suggests, what has been done. And it's not difficult, and nobody can soft sell it. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. And it begins in compassion. We have to, I think, look in the flaws in ourselves and look in the other person and hand this gift over. And so there are different kinds of forgiveness, of course. It can be acts of betrayal or meanness between individuals, but also between nations as well.
I have the impression that there can be a cost to not forgiving, that if we hold on to our injured feelings, that it may cost us something. Can you comment on that?
Sorry, can you reword that a bit? I'm not quite sure where you're going.
Well, I'm asking if holding on to our sense of injury and not forgiving exacts perhaps a medical cost or a psychological cost or some other sort of cost.
Well, that's a very brilliant question. And I don't believe there's any one answer for that. Everything you suggested takes a part in that. so we can try to deconstruct it a little bit. Reasons not to forgive. Pride is an enormous one. We've been hurt. It may sound curious, but to stand in the position of the wounded one, the hurt one, the betrayed one, can actually give us a little bit of moral superiority over someone else who has hurt us. We then get into a game of Ozies with someone. You've been meaner to me than I have been. This goes on between individuals as well as nations. There may also be the psychological or biological component, which I'm not terribly erudite on, other than the capacity for some people, apparently, for empathy is much stronger than others. So I have a 15-year-old son, and so my wife and I have been very careful about this component in his behavior. And it seems some children are either born into the world with more empathy than others, or it is nurtured along. But it's very important to know that first move is a move of identifying something in the other person that is human. This person has made a mistake. This nation, this corporation, this business has made a mistake. And the question is whether or not we can go on from here. There was a beautiful letter I saw in the Dublin Times, Dublin, Ireland, last fall when I was in Ireland. And it was about the troubles in the north, which, of course, are still plaguing people. If you've had someone murdered through what they call the troubles in Northern Ireland, it's very, very difficult to let go of that. But this one woman wrote into the Dublin Times and said, "We must allow someone who has asked for forgiveness and has tried to make amends to go on with their life. We need to go on with our lives." And that's a major point of it. And that then brings up this mystery element in the whole reconciliation question. I deeply believe, and I'm so glad you asked me this question, Dave, that some people will not make that next move of forgiveness if they see in the other person or the nation, let's say it's a political ambassador, if there is no effort to prove the forgiveness. In other words, to offer to make amends, to make an offer of somehow restoring the balance that has been thrown asunder. And in my experience, studying the work of Desmond Tutu in South Africa or the restorative justice movement, I've noticed that people are much, much more likely to forgive if the offer on the other side, the person who has oppressed you, the person who has turned you into the victim, has said, "I'm not only asking for your forgiveness, but you know what? I want to make things right again." It seems to be that offer of atonement is what will often seal the deal if it's difficult for someone to forgive.
Okay, well, we'll be getting to the other side of the coin there, atonement, in just a bit, but sticking with forgiveness a bit longer here. You've indicated that there's personal forgiveness and there's collective forgiveness, and you've mentioned South Africa, which certainly is an example most of us are familiar with in terms of collective forgiveness. Are there similar or other examples on the of collective forgiveness?
Well, certainly. For me, just in case the listeners have already forgotten or don't know some of the details there, part of the genius of Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela's attempt to bring not only peace to South Africa, but to bring a bloodless peace, a peace that was achieved with very little bloodletting, especially in proportion to what was expected. And that is because Tutu, from his 1989 biography on, said, "When apartheid ends, when we do have peace between the whites and the blacks in South Africa, we are not only going to offer forgiveness, but we are going to ask for restitution." That is his word for atonement. His notion was, if you murdered someone as a police officer with those death squads, or if you stole land or cattle, okay, we will forgive you in the notion of peace. We need eventual peace, but you have to meet us halfway and make some kind of restitution. In that light, there have been there has been for the past 30 years or so a really strong movement in many places for this kind of restorative justice thinking, so that there are efforts for, there have been efforts, for example, in Germany since World War II, not only to ask for forgiveness for what happened underneath the scourge of the Nazis, but to offer amends. I believe, I write in my book here, in my introduction to the Beyond Forgiveness book, a brief anecdote about what I saw living in Israel on a kibbutz in the 1970s, and that is, every 2 weeks, there was a group of young German students who came to our kibbutz, and it was one of my jobs to help train them, working in the olive date groves and banana groves and so on. They had been sent there by the German government, all expenses paid, to meet Israeli Jews and to begin to break down that whole process of demonization of the other, which can lead to death camps and so on. And beyond the idea of offering money for what happened underneath the Nazis in World War II, I find this to be a very emotional and very gratifying and, let's say, life-affirming effort at atonement, where you try to make amends and make a gesture towards the future so that what happened in the past may not happen again.
You know, you mentioned your introduction, which I thought was really wonderful, and in it you quote Houston Smith as saying, you quote him saying, "So the power of the act of forgiveness is the recognition of the flaw in all of us." Can you say a bit more about that?
Yes, this is my friend Houston Smith, the great historian of religion. We've worked together for the last 20 years on a number of book projects and film projects surrounding Native American spiritual issues. Currently, I'm working on his memoirs with him, which is very exciting. And I was honored to have Dr. Smith write the foreword to this book, Beyond Forgiveness. And in there, he blessed me, he blessed really all of us with this uncannily psychological insight that often, I believe what he's inferring there is often it's difficult, if not impossible, for us to make this move into forgiveness if we refuse or cannot recognize that what someone has done to us, either individually or collectively, isn't something that we could do. So, for example, someone hurts us, steals money, steals our car, betrays our friendship in some way. We can either say, oh, I'll never speak to that person again, or you look into that person's heart and you see that what has happened is something we may have done ourselves in the past, or that we have the potential to do. Or even if it's something that's beyond our comprehension. As Mother Teresa says, forgive them anyway, which I think is a remarkably benevolent thought. But this is Houston's idea is, I think, goes back to the ancient Greeks. The idea of the human flaw, what they call the harmartia, is what is visible there in all heroes, in all drama throughout human history. That's what the story revolves around. Every human being has a flaw. And if you can identify that and take a deep breath, take a deep sigh and say, that flaw in that person, greed or lust or moral superiority, is the equivalent of the flaw in my own heart, in my own character, then it's much easier to meet someone halfway. I have found that there is one line from a fairly obscure but important philosopher from the first century, someone named Philo of Alexandria, a wonderful Jewish philosopher in ancient Egypt, who said something that has given me a lot of solace over the years, and it's this: be kind to everyone you meet, because he or she is also enduring a great struggle. That can change the way that you walk down the street. It can change the way that you arrive at work in the morning. If you realize or acknowledge, maybe that's the better verb here, acknowledge that you aren't the only one in the world with problems, that that person on the other side of the desk who may be trying to take your house in a mortgage deal and so on. Everybody's enduring a great struggle. But then it comes up to a very curious crossroad there. There are some things that seem to be beyond forgiveness, right? Genocide and so on. What happened with the Lost Boys of the Sudan? There are some horrific things that human beings can perpetrate on one another. Well, one of the essays in our book, I think, helps us address this. Jacob Needleman, the great American philosopher, said that in growing up as a Russian Jew and having to deal with the memories of what occurred in Europe in World War II, Jewish philosophy helps him a great deal in this way, that you learn to hate the act, but not the actor. So we can despise what is done to children in abuse situation, or we can hate what happens in war, the depredations of war, but hate the act and not the person. That seems to be pretty common in human psychology. I've noticed this a great deal in Native American situations, where you can hate the act of someone stealing something in a small community on a reservation somewhere in the Amazon or here in America. But it's very, very, very dangerous and corrupting to hate the person. We don't know the circumstances. It could be chemical, as you suggested, Dave. It could be psychological in a way that is beyond our comprehension. So to move that rancor into the act rather than the person, I think, is very helpful.
Yes, yes. I'm so glad about all these points that you're making. And also earlier you mentioned compassion, and that's certainly a strong theme coming from Buddhism, and that would seem to relate very much to what you've just been saying. I'm not sure if you heard me there.
No. Can you ask that again, please?
Yeah, it wasn't so much a question as an observation that earlier you had mentioned compassion, and certainly Buddhism would seem to address this issue similarly, as you were pointing out that Judaism has.
Yes, exactly. And there again is an opportunity to go into the etymology of a word to help us garner some deeper understanding. To be compassionate literally means to feel the struggle with someone else. Passion is struggle, the heat of the struggle. To feel with someone, to feel their deep struggle in being a human being, in dealing with their own troubles, with their own sorrows. If we can make that magical act, then it is easier to forgive. Not necessarily to forget, because we need to learn what has happened in all of our experiences, even the destructive ones, even the hurtful ones. But the compassion, and from the Buddhist point of view, is very curious. On one hand, their cosmology, as Reverend Hung Shur, in the interview that he writes for this book of mine, Beyond Forgiveness, he suggests that on some level, we have already forgiven ourselves, and we need to lead our lives. Or you can look at the hurt someone has perpetrated in the world as karma. They are working out their karma, so we need to understand that and then move beyond. But on the other hand, the compassion. There's a marvelous story that the Dalai Lama tells about an old Tibetan scholar that had been imprisoned by the Chinese for somewhere in the realm of 20 years, a terrible, brutal imprisonment where he was forced to live, I believe the story is, under a staircase in a small room for 20 years, a very humiliating imprisonment. And when this man was released from prison, His Holiness the Dalai Lama met with him and asked him a curious question, one that most of us wouldn't even consider. But he said, were there any moments when you felt your moral fiber weakening? Did you feel any moments of weakness towards your tormentors? And apparently this Tibetan scholar told the Dalai Lama, yeah, there was one moment that was very, very terrible in those 20-plus years of imprisonment. And, of course, the Dalai Lama says that's when I was expecting him to tell me they physically tortured me. This is what most of us would think about, right? But instead, the Tibetan scholar said it was the moment when my compassion began to wane a bit, began to fade a bit for the Chinese, and I began to hate them. And then the Tibetan scholar said, and of course I had to deal with that, and I learned to meditate, and I worked my way through it. But I find this very, very instructive, that part of the strength that can help us endure a terrible torment on an individual or a collective level begins there, with our ability to identify with the humanness of other people, including those who have hurt us. And Dave, I'm glad you brought that up, because you see what I've tried to accomplish here in this book is approach this very powerful topic of what I think of as deep, long-lasting reconciliation from two points of view, combining forgiveness and atonement, but to do this from the Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Native American, psychological, literary points of view. I really tried to cover the bases with this book, and I believe that all the major traditions are covered in these 15 chapters. And what happens then, if you get to the end of the book, is you realize that this has been a long-standing concern for human beings. We need to know how to live together, right? In an apartment with our family, yeah. in a neighborhood with our tribe,
right.
or in a country. And long, deep-seated resentments over problems of betrayal and meanness can poison that. And yet, I find it very inspiring to know that every religious, spiritual tradition in the world has had an atonement process that deals with this.
Well, let's look at that other side of the coin that you've been referring to, atonement. I have to say that I've been aware of the importance of forgiveness, but much as happened for you, but hadn't given as much thought to atonement. And just reading the title of your book that I think has atonement in the subtitle, it was like a shock of recognition, you know. Oh, yeah, of course. So say a bit about atonement and why it's important.
Sure, of course. Thank you. First of all, the word itself is very powerful. It goes back to William Tyndale, someone who did two important things. He wrote one of the first dictionaries, a dictionary before Samuel Johnson's famous English dictionary, and he was also a translator of the Bible. And as he was translating from the Latin into English, he was searching for a word for, guess what, for reconciliation. And he couldn't find one that satisfied him. And so he took this old word that goes back much longer, atone, which originally meant at one, to be at one. And the inference, the suggestion there, of course, is to be in a state of accord, to be in a state of harmony or peace. And he stretched that out to suggest at-one-ment, which is the state of being at one, not divided in ourselves, schizophrenic, so to speak, or not permanently divided, let's say, with a brother that we're fighting with, or with a teacher, a philosopher, an employer, a politician. It is very easy for our sense of oneness with our spouse, with a best friend. It's very easy for that to be cut asunder, so to speak. And so one of the dreams, of course, in psychology, in mythology, in human relationships, in political relationships, to move from that idea of being separate, the idea of being split asunder from people we know or love, and somehow become at one again. And so the idea of atonement, up until recently, unfortunately, has been used almost exclusively by theologians. So if you look it up through Google, if you look it up in your local library, you'll find hundreds of books on the Christian theological notion of at-one-ment, which is very, very briefly the idea that we were all born with original sin, Jesus was born, died on the cross, atoning for all of our sins. And because of that one act, we will all be resurrected and we will go to heaven and so on. That's very briefly said, but that's essentially it. And yet, even if one isn't in accord, so to speak, with that reading, it does have the seed of something that is enormously helpful for all the rest of us. And that is, if we sacrifice something, often our pride, our sense of shame, our sense of humiliation, our sense of being hurt, and then holding that hurt over other people. Oh, look, I've been wounded more than you. We say that as friends, right? We say that as nations to each other. You hurt more of us than we hurt of you, and so on. If you can move past that, if you can sacrifice, see, that's the element in Christ dying on the cross. If you can sacrifice that sense of pride, you might be able to be at one again. And it's that form of atonement which leads us into the whole second half of our show, which is what is just thrilling to me about this book and how it might possibly help. Let me give you a brief example. This man, Ed Tick, and his wife, Kate Dahlstedt, they're two psychologists who specialize in post-traumatic stress for war veterans, prisoners, and so on. So this is not lightweight consideration here. This is as heavy as it gets. They deal with veterans, often from Vietnam, who have been in therapy. They have said they were sorry. They've even been forgiven, let's say, by some of the Vietnamese. And yet, Dave, they still aren't healed. What is going on there? When we attempt to say we're sorry and we seek forgiveness, well, what happens is very often the world doesn't believe us. We don't believe ourselves. But there is this missing key. Atonement says you need to sacrifice something. You need to prove with an actual act, a human act, that you can put things right again. And so what the soldiers are encouraged to do, in this one example of Ed and Kate taking their soldiers back to Vietnam, is they need now to prove their sorrow, their remorse. What do? They build an orphanage. They buy water buffalo for some local farmers in Vietnam because they remember, and I know two examples of this, they used to use water buffalo for target practice. And so how do you ever say you're sorry when you know you kill a water buffalo and you can destroy an entire tribe's way of life or a village's way of life for a short time? So you go back and you make amends. That's what atonement is. You try to make amends. You make something up. You offer a gesture to try to make things right again, to bring things back into accord, to set things right again.
This is all wonderful. Let me get personal here. Having rubbed elbows with these folks and with this topic now at such a deep level, I'm wondering if forgiveness and or atonement have been important in your own life.
Yes, certainly. In two cases. One, of course, is in the deeply personal. My family broke up when I was 17, growing up in Detroit. And for many, many years, I was very angry with my father for some of his behavior at home and for my mother for precipitating the divorce. And yet I knew as I grew older that I had to let that go. I started doing some work with Robert Bly, the great poet and one of the leaders of the men's movement. And I, to this day, I remember the tone of his voice when he said, "You don't grow up until you stop blaming your parents."
Mm.
Wow. That was an arrow quivering in my forehead. And so I learned to forgive them, and especially as I got older, I saw how hard it is to be a parent. I recognized the flaw in them. I recognized that they were doing the best they could. And then I recognized all of that in myself as well as I got older and I became a parent on my own. And so I made a move beyond that. And ever since, I knew that there were years of bitterness when I was mean towards them in the very human way that we will be mean towards people who have hurt us, right? This is our response to them. And so I tried to make amends all these years by making visits to them, by giving them gifts, by talking to them about our early life together. And that's been important, to try to make up for lost time, to try to make things right. And it all begins with this idea of compassion, understanding that they were also enduring a great struggle. Like that famous philosopher Philo said, Then on the collective level, it happened to me in a couple other ways. This may be helpful for listeners as well. I found it very curious when I was traveling around Europe in the 1970s, and then ever since, I lead pilgrimages around Europe. I lead tours. I'm there on film shoots and so on. And I continue, for 30 years, I have met people who refuse to go to Germany or Japan because of what happened during World War II. They may have heard a story or seen a movie or read a book, or maybe they fought in those wars, and they have refused to let go of that anger for obviously terrible depredations, things that happened there. And yet, in my way, I try to say that we need to let go of this, because I was angry at the same time about what America was doing in Vietnam and then in Central America. And much of my life then as a writer and a filmmaker has been to try to make amends, to help foster some kind of an understanding between nations. A lot of my work is involved in international causes, much of it in Native American issues. I, like many others, have been very angry about what happened to American Indians in this culture. And yet it's not enough just to be bitter or angry or ashamed. Instead, is there something we can actually do about it? Can we make amends? Now, in that light, my film partner in all these projects was a fellow named Gary Ryan from Malibu out here in California. And Gary told me once that, again, being born Jewish, there wasn't anything that he could do about what happened under the Nazis in World War II. However, there was something that he could do about what he called the American Holocaust, but it happened here in America to American Indians. And so he devoted the whole second half of his life and asked me to work with him to help make amends, to help atone for what had happened here in our own land, in our own country. So we ended up making 6 films together with Houston Smith, on many of these, by the way, on Native American issues. And all through the years, Dave, I found it very interesting that many people in art, in the world of theater, in dance, in literature, in the movies, have this notion of atonement in them, that something has happened in their lives, personally or collectively, that has so deeply embittered them, and they realize that the creative act itself can be a form of atonement, can be a way to make amends for things that happened in the past.
Fascinating, really fascinating. Phil, I'd like to take the time we've left to talk about your own very fascinating career. You've written a whole raft of books. I think you're up around 25. But one enduring theme in your work seems to be myth and storytelling. I see you've even written a book about Joseph Campbell. How did you come to be interested in myth and stories, and did you have contact with Campbell?
Well, sure. My fascination with myth, mythology, goes all the way back to my boyhood. I grew up in Detroit in a family that was all about cars. My father worked for Ford Motor Company there in Detroit in public relations for 33 years. He helped launch the Mustang. So we loved those cars. But at night, we often read books out loud together as a family. We actually read the classics one page at a time.
Oh, wonderful.
My father, my mother, my brother, sister, and myself. And this whole love of mythology got into me back then. We would go to museums in Detroit or Toledo or Cleveland, all the way to New York, to see exhibitions on the ancient Greeks and Romans. And that love of those stories stayed with me my entire adult life. And then in the late 70s, I got a chance to meet Joseph Campbell, the great scholar of mythology. And lo and behold, after a few years of casual meetings at seminars here in San Francisco or at the Clift Hotel in the Redwood Room, we would meet for a glass of Glenlivet. I eventually got the chance to write, co-write, and produce the movie about his life called The Hero's Journey, which, after 20-plus years, is still a staple on public television. So I got to work very closely with Campbell for 3 years, 84 to 87, on the story of his life. And that book And that documentary film ended up being the launching pad for my literary career, because I was able to parlay the film into my first book deal on Campbell, called The Hero's Journey, which is still in print after all these years. And so what was it I learned from Campbell? One, of course, is the whole notion of the hero's journey, that all of us with a pulse, so to speak, those of us who are avidly curious, Dave, those of us who have a sense of passion about the world, are on a journey. And Campbell isolated this as the hero journey, which essentially, this isn't just the story of Rocky, okay, Sylvester Stallone. It's the search for the self. If you refuse to take all of the models of behavior that have gone before you, when dad says, be a lawyer, or mom says, be a housewife, or someone says, who the heck are you to go and live in Paris? If you say no to all those social strictures and simply try to find your own way in the world, your own path, you're on the hero's journey. And it's curious, I find, when I go back to reread Campbell's classic, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, it's one of the most important books of the 20th century.
Yeah, I've taught out of that book for years. It's just one of my favorite books. Yeah.
Well, it's essentially trying to find a model of behavior in mythology, fairy tales, legends, theater plays, and all the way up to modern movies. So here's someone, Campbell, who saw Buffalo Bill and Annie Oakley performing in Madison Square Garden in New York in 1910. And then he was spending his last few years with the Grateful Dead and George Lucas of Star Wars fame. Because what he had tried to do in all this time was, is there anything, Dave, that we all have in common in human history? And Campbell's notion was, it's the search for the self. But to find yourself and really forge your own way, your own path, I find it amazing that he has a whole stage there in The Hero's Journey on atonement.
That's right.
What it says is, if you want to separate yourself, let's say, from your parents, from your tribe, from some social mores that you may not agree with, that you think may even be morally wrong, you have to find a way to let go. You have to find a way to sacrifice and let go of that other world to become yourself. So I found it amazing, an amazing kind of synchronicity when I was working on my book on atonement here, this new book, Beyond Forgiveness, that Campbell, my old teacher, my old mentor, had actually explored this a great deal.
Yes. You know, this is a little bit of a diversion, but I have heard Campbell accused of anti-Semitism, and I find that just very difficult to believe. Can you say anything one way or another about that?
Well, I'd be happy to. It's been an old charge, but it's a curious one because I spent 8 years with him, and what I found in him was what one of the producers on The Hero's Journey once called Campbell's loose cannon behavior. In other words, he was so passionate about this idea of the individual standing up against society to say, I am different, I am unique, I have my own destiny. And then eventually, of course, you come back with that gift that's called the boon in mythology, and you rejoin the community. It's not like you're a rebel forever. But when you come back, and so what Campbell did disdain, if he had a disdain in his life, it was for what he called the chosen people mentality.
Uh-huh.
And what he was referring to, if you spent enough time with him like I did, was the chosen people mentality that could be the whites over the blacks in the Deep South in America, or the whites over the blacks in South Africa, or the chosen people mentality of the Vatican when the church was perpetrating its own form of evils during the Middle Ages. Or it could even be the chosen people mentality, Campbell, I heard him say this a few times, in the New York literary world, where there was a kind of disdain or a condescension of the East Coast establishment, the chosen people, if you will, of the literary world, towards the bourgeois in middle America, the little people all across the country. And so Campbell would often use this phrase, and if you didn't know him and know his work and know what he was alluding to, you would think that he was using a kind of code for Jews. And I found that deeply distressing, because there is this element there of the Jews as chosen people, but that's usually a very, very old reading of it. Most modern contemporary Jews would not agree with that whatsoever. There's much more of an emphasis on our common destiny. And that was Campbell's huge message, and that's why I think it's very important to read him and his message of the hero journey is the search for the self. Who am I? Where do I fit in into the world community? And is there a way that I can add some kind of creative work out there in the world to really battle this old mythology, so to speak, the old mythology of the chosen people, which, as we know, leads in one direction. It always leads to war and violence, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, thanks so much for giving that added perspective, because that's something that's troubled me, and I'm really glad to get your view on that. Now, the film series that you worked on, is that the same series that Bill Moyers was the interviewer?
No. That was The Power of Myth. That's the six-part series of interviews that Bill Moyers did with Professor Campbell in 1986 and 87. The film that I'm speaking about is called The Hero's Journey, The World of Joseph Campbell, and that's the biographical film that we did on Professor Campbell, and it explores his life from New York going to live Europe, and then later on in life being a tremendous influence in the world of literature and movies and modern music. And that film is still available, and my book is still in print, called The Hero's Journey, The World of Joseph Campbell.
Okay, well, I'm sure that I've seen that film, and I just need to go back and look at it again. Now, before we wrap up here, you mentioned this online video series that you've been doing, and I guess it's still going on, Global Spirit. You want to say a little bit about that?
Yes, of course. About 10 years ago, or in the late 1990s, a man named Kim Spencer saw that Americans were losing their access to international news. Let's say when I was growing up, and Walter Cronkite was on the air, so the Americans might have 8 to 10 minutes of international news in a 60-minute program at 6 o'clock every evening, so we would know what was happening around the globe. But these days, that's down to under a minute. It's sometimes 30 seconds of international news, and that's it. You know, only 14% of Americans even own passports, for goodness sakes. So we are the least linked people in terms of knowledge about the rest of the world of any Western culture. And so Mr. Spencer founded this new satellite TV station called Link TV, which is available on DirecTV and the Dish Network all around the country, and it's now available on the Internet as well, linktv.org. You can find it anywhere. It's 24-hour programming about the entire globe. It's some of the best TV. It also has some of the best music videos available anywhere, world music. 2 years ago, one of his producers, Stephen Olson, thought that he might do for culture, psychology, spirituality, what Kim had been doing for politics for these last 10 years. And so he brought me on as the host and co-writer of a series called Global Spirit. And it's now nicknamed the first internal travel series. Pretty clever moniker.
Yeah.
And briefly, what it is, it's a weekly program in which I have 2 to 3 guests from other cultures around the world. And we strain hard to make sure that we're representing the other faiths, the other traditions, and a good balance between men and women in the program as well. We have now shot 16 programs, and we are about to launch on a second series. We have guests like Karen Armstrong. Her book, The Battle for God, is very, very important for understanding the world after 9/11. Robert Thurman, the great scholar of Buddhism. Deepak Chopra and Rian Eisler were on a recent show of mine. But we also have a shaman. I had a shaman from Greenland on a show about shamanism recently. And Bill Harney, a visionary painter from Australia, an Australian Aborigine elder, in conversation with Stephen Eisenstadt, the president of Pacifica Institute, talking about dreams, the deep reality of dream time.
Oh, wonderful.
So if listeners are interested, they can see our show every Sunday night at 6 p.m. on Link TV, but they can also go on the World Wide Web. They can go to the web and look up Global Spirit TV or linktv.org and see the show. We're about to start a whole second season of 16 more shows, and the word is that PBS will be picking us up next year.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, Phil, I really want to thank you, Phil Cousineau. Thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
I've been very happy to be in conversation with you. This is the way of the world. There, peace is possible as long as we are still in conversation.
I trust you enjoyed this interview with Phil Cousineau. I know I did. What an amazing career he's having, getting to interview and rub elbows with some of the great spirits of our time. By the way, as you heard, two of the essays in his book are by previous guests of mine. In case you missed them or wish to review them, you'll find my August 2007 interview with Dr. Edward Tick as Shrink Wrap Radio number 109 on War and the Soul. And by the way, that important interview is one I'd still really love to have someone step forward to transcribe. Also, my interview with Azim Kamisa is from 2009, and it's Shrink Wrap Radio number 221 on the secrets of the bulletproof spirit, and it's a marvelous one. You can imagine how gratifying it is to me that increasingly I'm finding that when my guests mention a key figure, it's someone I've already interviewed. It's a small world, and we're all so interconnected. Speaking of interconnection, one of the points that touched me during today's conversation with Phil Cousineau was his discussion of Campbell's atonement as at-one-ment, to be in a state of harmony or peace, to move beyond the feeling of separateness and to become at one again. This put me in mind of the film I recently raved about on the show here, Tom Shadyac's I Am. Be sure to see it when it comes to your area. You'll recall the thrust of that film was to figure out what the fundamental problem in our world is, and the answer that emerged out of a number of marvelous interviews with spiritual leaders, philosophers, and academics was our mistaken sense that we are separate, separate from one another and separate from nature. I also really appreciated the opportunity to get some perspective on the accusation that Joseph Campbell was anti-Semitic. That was a charge that just didn't make sense to me. And Phil Cousineau's explanation has really put that to rest for me. You can find out more about Phil Cousineau by going to his website at www.philcousineau.net. And Cousineau is spelled C-O-U-S-I-N-E-A-U. And look for his Global Spirit video series at linktv.org.
On the couch again with Dr. Dave, and Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah, it's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hey, everybody. I'm happy to report that our subscriber numbers seem to have been on the rise. I'm very pleased about that. I'm hoping it's because you've been recommending Shrink Wrap Radio to lots of people. By the way, there are flyers on our site that you can print out and post in public places to let people know about the show, or you can send them to relevant folks in an email as an attachment, or post links to the flyers in Twitter and or Facebook. You'll find them on our site under the Promos tab at the top of the page. And by the way, if you're not subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio, it costs you nothing to do so. It just means the episodes get automatically delivered to you, and it does help me to track our audience size. The easiest way to subscribe, I think, is through iTunes. And there is a subscription link to iTunes in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Now, speaking of iTunes, if you love this show and you haven't posted a review on iTunes, please do so. That's one of the things that keeps us on the front page of their higher education shows, or at least it has done so in the past. I just checked, and we're no longer there. Darn. But usually after a new episode is released, we get back up there. So I'm going to check after this has been out for a day or so. So you can see your subscribing is very important. Let me remind you that another way you can listen to this show is by using the Stitcher app on your smartphone. I believe that app is probably available for all smartphones. Search for it in your mobile store. It's spelled S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R. I noticed that in the iTunes store, it's called Stitcher Radio, and it's free. It lets you listen to your favorite podcasts and radio stations without using up a lot of memory space downloading the shows onto your mobile device. It works by streaming them to you. Personally, though, I don't mind taking up the memory space on my iPhone with recent episodes from my favorite podcasts because streaming sometimes stammers. If you haven't done so already, be sure to check out my latest interview on my other podcast series at wisecounselpodcast.com. The most recent is an interview with Marilyn Wedge, PhD, on family therapy. She's the originator of strategic child-focused family therapy, following in the family systems therapy tradition of Jay Haley, Salvador Minuchin, and others. This interview will be of interest to all therapists and would-be therapists, and parents too, because she comes up with very clever strategies that greatly reduce the need for prolonged treatment. And remember, all these Wise Counsel interviews have a transcript on the site as well. By contrast, the interviews here on Shrink Wrap Radio get transcripts only if volunteers step forward to do so. Thanks to the generosity of our listeners/transcribers, most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free. So thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen. I think it's a great value for everyone. And we have a couple of shows that are currently in the process of being transcribed. Hopefully I'll be able to announce them in the next episode. And we can always use more help in this regard. So please contact me if you would be interested in being a volunteer transcriber. You can help to support our show and save yourself some money by using the discount codes you'll find on our site for Angie's List, for Inkjets.com, and ShoeBuy.com. Angie's List certainly seems to be gaining momentum because I've recently seen television advertising from them. That's a good thing because it means that more and more people will be adding their unvarnished feedback and recommendations and ratings of service providers such as dentists and plumbers and contractors and all sorts of other providers of services across the U.S. This added exposure makes it more likely that you will find recommendations for service providers where you live. So take advantage of the rather substantial discount you'll find at shrinkwrapradio.com to become a subscriber to Angie's List. Thanks to all of you who've made financial donations to Shrink Wrap Radio, and I especially appreciate several people who've renewed their year-long pledges. That provides an important, predictable base, which is greatly appreciated. So if you haven't done so yet, please go to shrinkwrapradio.com and click on that big green donate button. And thank you.
Hi, this is Dr. Stephen Porges, researcher, author, and director of the Brain Body Center at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Stephen Porges, who will be my guest on our next episode. More about that later. Now let's check out some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Felix, who is writing from Down Under. And he says, "Hey, Dr. Dave, just letting you know that I really enjoy your talks with Jerry and am looking forward to the next installment. Keep up the good work, Felix." Felix, thanks for that encouragement. It's been wonderful to hear from you and others egging us on. And it doesn't take much egging, I can tell you. In a similar vein, a person with the moniker of Tenacity posted the following comment on episode number 262 in response to my last interview with Jerry Trumbull. And Tenacity says, "I must admit, I don't really understand all of these intriguing conversations with Jerry Trumbull. I get swept away with the enthusiasm and ideas. I do have a few questions for part three. What happens if a person is blind? I know that people who had vision once and then lost it often still have visual dreams. I believe that some of my dreams are more sensory than visual and some more auditory. After I had a stroke in 2002, I believe the auditory dreams increased. Often I hear music in my dreams and have no visual imagery that I can remember. Where does all of that fit into this?" Well, that's a good question, and I don't know where all of that fits into this. I have forwarded your comment to Jerry Trumbull, and he's got your email address, so you may be hearing back from him, Tenacity. Or maybe it'll come up in our next conversation. Now here's another one from Down Under, this one from Adam, who writes, "Thank you, Dr. Dave, for your podcast show. I am from Melbourne, Australia, and studied some psychology at university, and it has always been a source of interest to me. I've since gone on to work in the engineering/construction field, but have felt drawn back to my interest in the area. Your podcast has been a fantastic way to reignite that former interest. I discovered your podcast as something to listen to whilst cleaning my apartment in preparation to move out. That was 1 week before Easter, and I've since listened to 40 of your podcasts." Oh, what a tribute. Thank you. He goes on, "Again, Dr. Dave, thanks for such a great show. Do you know of any other high-quality educational podcasting websites that you might be able to recommend? Wishing you all the best from Melbourne, Australia." And that comes from Adam. And I recommended the Australian public radio series All in the Mind, and also the Brain Science podcast, in case anybody is wondering. Now, the next one comes from the UK. Maita, and I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly, writes, "Hi there, I'm a psychotherapy student based in the UK and would love to download your podcast to play on my iPhone. Is this possible? I only seem to be able to play them on my home computer, not transfer them to my iPhone. Look forward to your reply." And that comes from Maita. Well, that's how I listen to podcasts, is on my iPhone, definitely. And the way to do it, there are two possibilities. I'm sure there are more than two, but the two that I recommended to Maita was, one is make sure you have iTunes on your computer, and then you go into iTunes. You need to create an account in iTunes and give them your credit card, even if you never plan to buy anything, and go to the iTunes store. And in the iTunes store, then you'll find a tab for podcasts. And then you look for Shrink Wrap Radio. So there's a podcast area in iTunes. You can find Shrink Wrap Radio. You can click on subscribe, and then it will start moving shows into iTunes. And every time that you sync up to iTunes, you'll get the latest shows. And if you want to listen to some old ones, you go into iTunes on and you go to the Shrink Wrap Radio page, and you put check marks by the back shows that you want to have downloaded onto your iPhone. So that's one way. Another way is to install a program called Stitcher. Actually, it's called Stitcher Radio in the iTunes store, and I'm sure it's available for other smartphones as well. And that will stream selected podcasts to you, and you can stream Shrink Wrap Radio that way. So there are two different ways that you can go. Please figure it out, and Maita, if you can't figure it out, call me on the number that I always give at the end of the show, or Skype me. You can contact me on Skype, and I'll talk you through it. The next one is from Sweden, and Michelle writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, my name is Michelle. I live in Stockholm, Sweden. I'm an undergraduate student at the psych department in Stockholm University, studying to become a psychologist. I haven't written to you before, but I'm an avid listener of your podcast, which I discovered through iTunes a few months ago. Since I've been listening to your podcast chronologically, I've only come as far as 2007, and I'm really looking forward to catching up to the present day. I'm wondering if you will be attending the Toward a Science of Consciousness conference in Stockholm, May 3rd to 7th. If you are, please let me know, and I'll do my best to be able to attend and maybe even meet you in person. Sincerely, Michelle." And, of course, at this point, May 3rd to 7th has passed. I did not go. I had follow-up correspondence with Michelle. It turned out that I think she did go. She even may have recorded some interviews for us to use on Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm still waiting to hear about that. And I would have liked to have gone. This was a conference organized by Hameroff, one of the fellows that Jerry Trumbull and I have been talking about. Well, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows, just like Tenacity did, in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, or you can call me up there. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And by the way, my name on Skype is ShrinkPod. Thanks again to Phil Cousineau for sharing his work with us on forgiveness and atonement. Now, on the next episode, my guest will be Dr. Stephen Porges, who is known for developing what he calls the polyvagal theory. As you may recall from my interview some time back with Dr. Dacher Keltner, the vagal nervous system plays a strong role in terms of our heart feelings of warmth and connectedness, as well as other things. And Dr. Porges is the person who has done much of the pioneering work in this area, and you don't want to miss that one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.